Hi, everybody. This is Dean Haglund from the Annex Gallery of Rational Exuberance here in the heart of the historic core, the Sidewalk Gallery, apparently, my art show will be coming up this June 9th.
What happens if I point the microphone this way? Will I get the same amount of echo
as I do when I am here?
It's audio tests here all day at your Chilpack Hollywood Hour.
I'm your friend in podcasting, Phil Lernis.
I'm Dean Haglund.
We're back in Los Angeles.
Last week,
of course, we were live at the Retro Dome in San Jose, California.
Wasn't that fun?
It was fun. It was a really fun show.
Seems like a year ago.
And today we're in your gallery on this Memorial Day Monday.
That's right.
And we were doing tests, as we do, the audio tests beforehand, and we were perhaps a little concerned at first about maybe there's too much echo or...
Street noise.
And then realized, well, wait, part of the fun is you knowing that this summer we will be taking you to many different locales.
You will be traveling. We'll travel with us around the world.
Because as loyal listeners of Chilpack Hollywood Hour know, we have been at this for more than 4 years now. We have never missed a week.
Never.
Every week we're here with an hour of free podcast entertainment.
Yes.
And
hilarity.
We'll be continuing that this summer, even as we travel. Including one thing we just arranged the other day, we'll be podcasting live from downtown Albuquerque from the Hard Rock Casino.
How cool is that going to be?
That's
at the end of August. That's going to be exciting for those people, our fans in Albuquerque, who are legion. Of course, when I say our Annex Gallery, this is at 845 South Broadway. By all means, this June 9th will be the opening of my art show called I Want to Believe, where you are welcome. It is part of downtown LA's Art Walk.
A month prior, you
had an opening.
You had what you called a soft opening,
right?
As part of Art Walk, where people could come in and actually watch you paint and talk and everything. What does that mean? I mean, I hear this a lot in terms of stores and in terms of galleries and things like this. What does a soft opening mean?
Soft opening means you don't really have your shit together. And so you're going to open anyway because you know there's lots of people that are going to come and you're going to just work out the kinks and the bugs and all of that sort of thing. So, for instance, we didn't really know the prices of a lot of our artwork. We didn't have a streamlined chain of command and who to talk to when you wanted to inquire about purchasing. We didn't have prints ready. So all of that's going to be ready for this.
So it's like a preview.
It's like a preview. Like an advanced showing, but now it'll be open to the public in general. And so anybody, welcome. June 9th, it'll be open from 5 p.m. all the way into the wee hours of the morning.
And it is kind of the with a theater, with seeing a stage show, when you can get sometimes tickets to sneak previews. Or
that's right.
Preview performances.
And
the beauty of it is that sometimes... you can get them for less money, the tickets. You can get better seats.
Right? Yes.
And because, of course, they may... And sometimes it's fantastic because you know what? The show is entirely up to speed.
That's right.
It may be the complete show with all the bells and whistles absolutely locked down. But they're still previewing it because, indeed, they always set aside a certain amount of preview performances because, of course, any show... does change once an audience is in there.
Right. And, of course, I had canvases up that weren't completed, but now you can actually see I have three canvases in the middle of working on them that I'll probably be painting all this week, and you can come and see how completed I get by June 9th.
Well, so I bring up this idea of a stage performance changing once you let an audience see it. Does a gallery showing change once you've had the feedback of seeing what it's like with people in here looking at it?
Yeah, absolutely. And then you realize which is your most popular pieces, most controversial. You rearrange them on the wall, perhaps to accentuate one's more the likability than the other.
Is it ever anything as individual, though, as you set up pieces in a certain way because it makes sense to you that this is the order in which they go, and then you see how people walk in, and you say to yourself, my God, they're all going against the grain.
Right, yeah, the traffic flow is totally ass backwards. So then you rearrange everything for that.
Fascinating.
Yeah, so we'll be fixing all of that, and there'll be some new works as well. So June 9th, everyone, if you're in the Los Angeles area, come on down.
It is Memorial Day.
We were realizing
that this means that this we've been podcasting since Memorial Day in the U.S. is always on a Monday.
Yeah.
It means that we've been podcasting for several Memorial Days in a row,
and not realizing.
Well, maybe we talked about it. Maybe we didn't.
I don't know.
I am moved to talk about it at least for a minute today because I read so much. On the Twitter, on the Facebook, of people saying, you know, Memorial Day, it's to honor our veterans. And that's not actually accurate.
No, I thought that was Remembrance Day.
Veterans Day.
Here, Canada, it's called Remembrance Day, and that's in November.
And we do have specific holidays, two distinct holidays for distinctly specific reasons.
Right.
And Memorial Day, memory, it's to remember those soldiers who died in service to their country, and as opposed to Veterans Day, which is to honor
our veterans.
And fortunately, there are many souls in living bodies
right.
that you get to directly honor and
say hello to.
And so this not only the distinction of that, but then also this idea of, boy, if what we're remembering is individuals who died in service to their country, it seems to me there's an opportunity for this day, as there are for all holidays, to constantly reinvent it and reclaim it. Because I don't know, Memorial Day, you think of barbecues.
Right.
And indeed, like with the 4th of July, I understand that it is memorializing and celebrating the sacrifice people have made to give us freedom, to keep us free, by celebrating that freedom, by enjoying that freedom.
Right.
Makes sense. This word, though, in that description, that Memorial Day is for those men and women who died in service to their country, it seems like service ought to be part of this holiday. Maybe how could we use this day to inspire more of us more often to
be
live
in service
to our country, to each other. And I just, on the way over here, walking here, especially on a holiday, it's so interesting to be walking around the city when there's so much less traffic and so much less street traffic.
And so many buildings, stores closed.
And you look at all the things, even in an area like downtown, which is thriving and is only becoming more thriving, but you look at all the civic improvements that could be made and ought to be made, and you think, how much of this could we, the people, accomplish if maybe just once every so often we threw in as a community and say, hey, this is a let's repaint community buildings day. Yep. This is a...
Perhaps you don't know about Love Eastern Columbia Day. That we have, where we, the residents of the Eastern Columbia, will actually go around our neighborhood, clean up, fix broken things, and actually put service back into our neighborhood.
And, I mean, wouldn't that be extraordinary if it was across the country?
A
day, Memorial Day is, Memorial Day 2012 is going to be the day that all across America... people within their communities band together to fix things that they can. Because, it is so easy, right, to go to that place of darkness and hopeless, like all the problems we're facing, what do we do? There's nothing we can do. But there is a surprising amount that I think we all know this, right around our own homes. There is a surprising amount you can take care of in a day if you just feel good about the fact that, hey, today
is
I'm going to tend to some of these things.
Going to fix this stuff. Well, that's a good plan. However, I also think some people need a day off if they work really hard, like we've been working really hard.
We don't have a day off, though.
We're here. I know.
Being of service through 1 hour of podcasting. Give till it hurts. That's our motto. You know what we do, though, in honesty? Well, really, we say give till it hurts, but really, we give, and then we give.
Right.
And then when we're done giving...
We drink.
No, we give some
more. Oh, we give some more, and then we drink.
Yes.
I get it. Sorry. I knew there was three gives in there. I didn't know the order.
And in all honesty, the word your is a very important part of your Chill Pack Hollywood Hour.
Yes.
And one of the things we mean when we say it's your Chill Pack Hollywood Hour is that you get to tell us what we talk about.
I love that part.
And
it makes it so easy.
We promised, did we not?
We did.
A couple weeks ago that on this show we would really get into maybe for 15, 20 minutes or so a discussion about a man whose name has come up quite often on this show, and surprisingly, more often than not, is brought up by you.
Yeah, ironically, isn't it?
And that man is David Lynch.
David Lynch,
filmmaker,
director,
artist. He's a painter.
Cartoonist?
Looks like you, yeah.
Cartoonist? The World's Angriest Dog is a cartoon.
Interesting. Now I'm starting to understand why maybe the animosity.
Are you seeing
the
connection?
The freedom he experiences challenges. Okay, I've got to rethink everything I'm going to write. No. So should I reset by just reading the lovely email we got
Go
from
ahead.
Caro? Dear Dean, dear Phil, I heard on your show there's a possibility of getting certain episodes. And so I sent her the episode where we discussed Mulholland Drive, at least one of the episodes where I know we did this, because she has a friend doing a thesis on Mulholland Drive for university. And Caro told him about the episode where the two of us discussed a little bit about David Lynch. And she couldn't remember all the discussion, but she did remember specifically Dean saying something about David Lynch being someone who throws paint at a wall just to see what comes out. Would that be like the Kandinsky of
Kandinsky?
Filmmaking?
Yeah, I guess. There's a little, well, whatever, go ahead.
I always picture I don't know where this comes from, but those movies of somebody throwing spaghetti at a wall.
Spaghetti at a wall. That's the metaphor I may have used instead of paint at the wall.
So we said that we would revisit this today, since I am, I truly admire David Lynch, not only his films, I admire his approach. And so what we said was that we would engage in a discussion about why I enjoy and admire David Lynch, why you do not generally admire and enjoy David Lynch, and then at the end of the discussion, we'll switch it up a little bit, and I'll talk about what I don't like nor admire about David Lynch, and maybe those exceptions where you do think he really
hit it
created
on the head.
Something that, that resonated
well,
for
and,
you.
And of course he's going to create something that resonates because of the very act of throwing spaghetti at the wall as your metaphor. Some of that spaghetti is going to stick and it's going to be delicious. That's just the nature of randomness in the universe.
If you like pasta.
Right. Well, he's working within a bunch of different genres. One of those pastas, you know, maybe it's not the cannoli that I was thinking, but it's going to be a
However, are you really meaning to say that just the law of averages says that anyone who does that would be able to come up with something artistically satisfying? Because I would argue that Uwe Boll is never going to make a satisfying movie. That Michael Bay is never going to make a satisfying movie.
I would disagree. I would say if Michael Bay had the same working procedure as David Lynch, he would come up with something.
I think it's absolutely impossible, because I think what we know about Michael Bay from his films is that he is absolutely blind to what is going on within his own unconscious.
Absolutely. David Lynch does
bring consciousness to his unconscious. So therefore, no, one is determined to remain unconscious, No, I don't think there is any odds that the artistry will resonate. I mean, I think we've talked about this before. Making a good movie, making any really resonant work of art, is incredibly difficult.
Right.
The odds are against you all the time.
All the time.
And if you're not even trying, then the odds are that much more diminished.
Okay, but if I made Michael Bay take the same working technique as David Lynch, that is, all things in and then whatever, as opposed to, I'm sure, how Michael Bay works. I don't even know how Michael Bay works, frankly.
Let's talk about David Lynch.
Let's just talk about David Lynch. I'm saying that there's the odds of probability. That's all I'm saying.
Well, you did mention, you know, working in lots of different genres. This is the thing that is extraordinary. When you look at David Lynch, you know, we all probably have a relatively similar view. Like, if we were to write down what a typical David Lynch scene would be.
Right.
It probably might involve a midget. There'd be a curtain of some kind. You know, we could all have certain things that we would describe. And yet, when you go through and you realize, sure, there's the Eraserhead David Lynch and the Blue Velvet David Lynch and Twin Peaks, Mulholland Drive. Then you look Elephant Man.
Yeah.
The Straight Story.
Dune.
You know, it's wow, he worked in different genres.
Yeah.
And the approach might be similar, But boy, based on the content, it does vary.
Right.
So.
But it also is how you came into seeing David Lynch first. I mean, what was your first David Lynch movie that made you fall in love with him like you did?
I fell in love with David Lynch by learning about David Lynch.
Before you saw his
Absolutely,
films.
Because as I always maintain to anyone who asks us, you know, what advice do we have for aspiring filmmakers or any artists, you know, my advice is always, if it's film, let's say, okay, what film do you love? Well, now learn as much as you can about the people who made that.
Right.
Learn about their approach. Learn about what other films they made. Check those out. If you find that you love those as well, then maybe find out who their influences were and start to study those people.
Right.
And it is through learning about the man where I really began to love David Lynch.
Right.
I'd say that the first film of his where I went, okay, this is a filmmaker with whom to grow old, to follow, whose failures may end up proving more interesting than most people's successes.
Right.
Was, of course, Blue Velvet.
Right. That's when his name sort of burst into this.
I mean, he was nominated for an Oscar for Elephant Man, which was nominated for many Oscars.
Right.
And was a wonderful film. However, my reaction to it was I sort of wished that they had done on film what they did on Broadway, which is no prosthetic makeup.
Yeah.
That the actor transformed and the hideousness of this physical being was expressed through the physicality of the actor and through the reaction to that actor by
everyone
else. Because, again, how powerful if you actually see, boy, there is no physical deformity,
right,
but everyone sure
reacted.
Seems to agree that there is.
It's like that Twilight Zone episode.
Well, because isn't that the truth of it?
Yes.
We all just agree on what is handsome and what is ugly.
And that was the metaphor in Victorian England when he was suddenly accepted by society and he was having tea with the highest of noblemen and all of that sort of thing.
You're talking about David Lynch.
Ah! never mind.
Now, okay, so why don't I start with something that
yes.
I love.
Love. Go
about
ahead.
David Lynch.
Go ahead.
And that's casting.
Mm.
We're going to answer a question later in the show from another listener about the function and art of casting directors. David Lynch, one has to say that he's adventurous in his casting. His casting is refreshing. He finds talent and gives them opportunities they've yet to have. I'm thinking of Naomi Watts, for example.
Right.
Long before Tarantino was doing this, he reclaimed careers for people. He gave people fantastic. Well, what about Dean Stockwell, who we were talking about earlier?
Oh, yeah.
From Blue Velvet. Dennis Hopper, Blue Velvet.
That was
Dennis Hopper, that was his comeback.
True.
You know, and Tarantino would be hailed for this so much, but David Lynch has always done this.
Yeah, but I'm going to argue.
And casting people in really interesting ways against type.
Okay, against
and casting actors because of just an affection that he had for them from something that may have inspired him to become an artist or a filmmaker in the first place.
Right, which is exactly what you'd want to do if you are not going to direct the actor. It seemed that he gave both Dennis Hopper free rein to go crazy with the huffing and the thing. And then
And it worked.
And it worked. Because the way he directs was so crazy and huffing as if I'm in the mind of Dennis Hopper. So by the very nature of him not directing Dennis Hopper or allowing him to go way off the deep end.
I would invert it just a little bit, though, because if he cast these actors out of his affection for them,
their skill level
when he was being inspired to be a storyteller and an artist and a filmmaker, these people already live in the mind of David Lynch. That's the point.
Wow.
And so think about how about Richard Boehmer
in
Tony from West Side Story in Twin Peaks. There has never been he and Ray Wise, the great actor Ray Wise,
who's
gone on to wonderful performances since then. But, of course, it was really Twin Peaks that created Ray Wise. And the two of them as villains in Twin Peaks, boy, I don't know if we've seen better villains on television than the two of them.
Okay. Here's the casting
is often really, really pleasing.
And I agree. And I think it actually saves him more than 10 times out of 20, for sure, because he allows them, maybe by not directing them at all, I don't know.
Well, I've said this before. You know, I like working with actors. I like directing actors. And 90% of what I can do to get a good performance out of an actor is casting the right person in the
first
place.
And then knowing,
and then getting out of their way.
Getting out of their way.
Except trying to give them what they might need.
Right. I'm not sure he gives them what they need. A la Lost Highway, Willem Dafoe. I would say that there was...
You need to rewatch that movie. That's a really good movie.
Okay.
That works really...
Okay, you know what? Maybe I should tell everyone how about
him reclaiming Robert Blake in that film?
Oh, yeah. Well,
Robert Blake's comeback.
Yeah, which, you know, maybe shouldn't have happened. Anyway, the point is that I saw a Broadway show.
I know, but this has nothing to do with this film.
No, but it's the same method of directing. You saw this Broadway show where there was a midget sawing wood, and the woman who sang the theme to Twin Peaks hanging from a thread, then falling through a 1940s roof of a car, then her body taken out, then air raid sirens going off. I mean, it was a mess of a play that made no sense.
I feel that to criticize a filmmaker for a play...
I'm criticizing a director for directing.
However, they are different mediums entirely.
Yes.
Is a great short story writer's short stories any less great because his novel doesn't work?
Well, then you're saying a guy who makes short films.
You're just saying that a writer is a writer. So he ought to be able to good at writing a first person column, and he ought to be able to write a good short story.
And those tweets better be funny.
And by the way, I have said this about, yes, if you've made a great short film, do you know what that means? It means you know how to make a short film. It doesn't mean at all that you can make a feature, that you should. And in fact, most of the time, it's borne out that you should not.
Right, exactly.
Because they are different forms.
Absolutely. Okay, so. That we have to take that off the table. Very good. So then,
unless what you want to say is no, and this
okay,
is the thing is that there was something that he revealed about himself in his approach to that stage play that bothers you in his films.
Absolutely, and that is the approach of scattershot. I will just call this. Spaghetti against the wall. We'll just term this now scattershot. And this scattershot, you know, I took my degree in university was multidisciplinary. I trained both in modern dance, ballet, theater, visual art, filmmaking, time management. The point being that there was very specific issues that would come up when you're doing multidisciplinary work.
Right.
And one of them is don't go scattershot, because that is just the lazy way out. That, yes, by the sheer odd probabilities, you're going to hit something that is both of the zeitgeist and psychologically revealing and something that will resonate with an audience around you. That, to me, is not doing your homework. What you should do is through a process, a rehearsal process, or a workshop process, or some other process, find those nuggets and not just depend on them to fall off the wall when I throw everything out there.
Does he always scattershot? Because the straight story is very contained.
Right. Dune is an example of when he doesn't scattershot. How lame that comes out. I mean,
on the other hand, like I'm saying, Straight Story is a great movie, and it still feels like David Lynch, and everything is of a piece in that.
True.
And Elephant Man, I would argue, until the science fiction ending.
Yeah, well, Elephant Man felt like there was executives.
Now, we are talking about two different pieces, though, Elephant Man and Straight Story, that he didn't write.
That's another good example.
So... how much of your criticism
is about his writing?
This is a fair question.
Yeah.
Are you criticizing the director or are you criticizing the writer? Because those are distinct things. Now, as a filmmaker, he's accountable.
Yes.
Right?
But he also brings in all of those flourishes. I mean, the close-up of Blue Velvet, for instance, is the ear being eaten by the ants as the MacGuffin and all of those sort of things. I mean, they seem to be. I'm trying to articulate this. instantly. So, but you're right. I'm thinking now that the writing, did he write Eraserhead? Because that,
I'm pretty sure.
Yeah. Because that one seemed to me that there was thought behind it, but at the same time, a freedom to go in. And that, for me, was like an excellent, I love that movie. And I saw it in New York late one night, and it was the very epiphany of what my New York experience was.
So are you saying that the danger with him was that he was rewarded so much for that kind of unique approach that he felt he had to recreate it without having a story that he was particularly driven to tell?
That probably is more to the case. I would think that's specifically Dune. It didn't even seem like he read the novels on some of them.
I'm sure he didn't.
Yeah.
Let me do just a quick list of the things that I wrote down that I admire about him, that I enjoy about him.
Okay.
And you can
shoot each one down.
Or weigh in on them, or you can hear them all and then go through whatever however you want to do it. Because I didn't put these in any order of importance, just as they. I've said this before, that this is important to me as a filmmaker, and especially as someone who loves watching films.
Right.
I love films where the location, the locale, is a character.
Right.
And in his works, I almost always feel that. I feel that the locale is a character, and maybe the most important character.
I would argue against that on Mulholland Drive, oddly enough, because to my experience of Mulholland Drive, being there, I don't think he actually captured it. I thought he captured maybe Hollywood's weirdness.
Well, that's it. Boom. If this is all a dream, and it's a dream about Hollywood, did he not capture that? And did he not capture that from the point of view of the outsiders?
Yes, newcomer coming in. Agreed. But then Mahal.
So now we go back. That did that small town in Blue Velvet not resonate as a character? Did Twin Peaks and the forest primeval around it not resonate as a character in the story itself?
Yes, but I would then argue that that is also desperately grabbing at all the strands you possibly can, again as spaghetti, to pull in.
I think
what
it's
you think.
Very difficult. If it were easy to do that, more filmmakers would do that. And most American films, the sense of location and place is not at all a character in it at all.
Absolutely.
It's because just something that the computer told you, shoot in Shreveport.
Right. Because I think there's a lot of people who are disconnected from their surroundings.
Yeah.
I
would say to you that even if you're right about the scattershot approach, he uses his surroundings to inspire so many of those flourishes
or
that
save
you
his ass.
Can't help but make the surroundings be. Now, if you want to say that the surroundings are more interesting than the people in it, okay, well, that's a valid criticism. And as someone who really wants place and time to resonate within a work,
right,
he does that as much as any American filmmaker.
Yeah, but okay, so you argue.
Which is one of the reasons that I think he's so hailed in Europe, because that is a European sensibility.
Absolutely, so true. Okay.
Fellini did this, even in his films where the characters didn't seem to have the inner life that they did in all his great ones. Boy, the streets were alive with the inner life.
Absolutely, yes. And that came from that verisimilitude, that post-cinema verite out of Italy.
And, you know, for two guys who talk so much about how maybe the most important thing in any story is the tone of that story and how it's the hardest thing to market, this is a filmmaker who truly embodies that sense. The thing that is special and worth probably remembering in the best of David Lynch, and sometimes even the worst of David Lynch, as a caution, is
yes.
is the tone.
True.
The tone is unique. The tone is, it's not, again, it's the product of a great deal of work.
Yeah.
And
I don't know much about his editing process, though. I suggest to you that he gets everything on in the box, then edits to tonal range so that.
Well, this leads to the next one, which is music. His use of music is signature. You do recognize from the music and how it's used that you're watching a David Lynch film.
And Twin Peaks theme song was huge.
And his background as an industrial filmmaker you know, making industrial films for corporations.
I did not know that. I would like to see one of those.
Oh, yeah, they're really fascinating. And they were almost all image with music.
Ah.
Because you know, this is long before music videos or anything And he does really, and not just music. I would go one step further using sound effects to create tone, to create character. He really, he does think out, and not in a scattershot way, in maybe his most specific way of anything that he does, he really crafts soundtrack.
Wow.
And
okay.
I think that's one of the really important aspects that creates the tone in these.
Now I want to see these industrials. Can I see them on YouTube?
I don't know. I'm sure he's released them in, or on his website, you know, where you can also, Dean, watch his web series.
Oh, what's his web series called?
He has several of them.
What?
Yeah, one of them gets shown in bits and pieces. You know, the ones with the big bunny heads get shown in bits and pieces in Inland Empire.
Oh, yes, of course.
I love, you know, that... More than, again, any other American filmmaker, he is committed to exploring the language of dreams through his films, to hold that mirror up to us.
As a dream interpreter, I'm sure you love that.
Of what we are going through all the time, whether we're aware of it or not, that I do love that. I love that... so many of his pieces are about the transformation of that we call death. Not death as an abyss or an ending, death as a transformation. I love...
I would argue that except for second season of Twin Peaks then. After we find out who killed Laura Palmer, there was nothing motoring that second season on. I mean, the transformation of death...
They finally found their footing towards the end when he came back to the show, though, significantly.
Really?
Yeah, he abandoned. You hear all that. The problem with the second season is that he abandoned it.
Why?
Because he'd already done what he wanted to. He didn't have... He wasn't signed... Even though he had a TV show, he wasn't signing up to do TV. He had to go make a crappy movie called Wild at Heart.
Oh, that's right. Wild at Heart. You know, I get Lost Highway and Wild at Heart mixed up, oddly enough.
I love... that he, that David Lynch, you know that you are going to see a piece that is almost always about fantasy and illusion.
Yeah.
Sometimes the fantasy and the illusion are very universal, fantasy and illusion. The White Picket Fence, the Hollywood Dream, whatever. But a film that is about, a story that is about fantasy and illusion, about exposing the dark nightmare beneath every fantasy and illusion, and at the same time showing the beautiful dream that interweaves and coexists with any dark nightmare, no matter how dark. He is a filmmaker that is committed to finding the light in the dark and at the same time constantly exposing the dark within the light.
Well, now you're just talking scattershot again to me, and what he's doing is either
actually,
coming up...
what I just described was the definition of integration.
Ah, isn't that interesting?
The yin-yang symbol.
I guess.
This is,
but at the same time, what it feels like to me is that he takes either a horrific image and makes it lovely, or takes a lovely image and adds the horror to it.
What's your biggest complaint about yourself and your life as an adult?
Disorganization.
And that you never stuck to one thing.
Ah, look at that.
That your approach has been incredibly scattershot.
Damn it. David Lynch, you are
me.
And
here's a man who is hailed universally, who is beloved.
Is he beloved?
He's absolutely beloved. No, he might be detested in equal measure. But again, I would think for you, Mr. Art History Major, that actually is as much a definition of a great artist than anyone else. Their work has to be, to a certain degree, polarizing. If it is not, it's not challenging in any way.
Yeah, that's
and so here's a man who is allowed to do what you blame yourself for doing. And he has been rewarded for it.
Only because he went to the right university.
What do you like? Rapidly, what do you like about David Lynch?
I like
you...
vivid imagery. I like his pacing. I like that even if something...
Well, that's a nice compliment. It's a sense of pacing. I mean, that's a powerful.
Very powerful. And I give them that anything that I hate, I know I'm not going to have to sit through it for 10 to 15 minutes. It's only going to be like a 3-minute thing of a midget coming out of a garbage can singing opera. And then that midget's gone. I don't have to see that anymore. And we can get back to what he's trying to get to. I really appreciate that. He does seem to have a story to tell. His funny comic strip, World's Angriest Dog, I don't know if you've seen it, where it's just a dog tied to a tree, and the story's going on, the balloons go through the window, there's somebody talking inside the house who you never see, and the dog just sits outside being very angry, that the story balloons are actually telling a story in the house, which I know anybody else who had that format probably wouldn't bother putting a story in there. So he does try to tell a story in some capacity. I appreciate that. Go ahead.
I talked about how much I like his casting.
Yes.
What I do not enjoy about him, what makes me not uncomfortable, but makes me very disappointed, and I continue to this day to sort of find distasteful, is the way that he exploits and often not makes fun of, but uses as the source of comedy people's age.
Ah.
Infirmity, disability. At its best, you know, you're getting back to that play about the midget on the stage, right? He is drawn to the physically eccentric. Can we call it
that? Sure, let's do that.
Is that a politically correct way of describing it?
I like
that. The physically eccentric, he is drawn to it. He's drawn to it in a sideshow way.
Yes.
And I am, and at its worst... It's played for laughs. Seeing Richard Pryor fully in the grips of his illness, barely being able to drool out his lines in Lost Highway.
Yeah,
and the fact that these scenes are comedic in nature was that's the real, to me, the dark side of Lynch's approach. And that's at its worst. At the most disturbing to me is that there often I find is a connotation of corruption or evil, downright evil, associated with those who are physically different from the norm.
Ah.
The midgets being evil.
Right.
Someone in a wheelchair being a person who
mayor.
Is corrupt in some way.
Right.
Now, you might think, for example, that Doc Hayward's wife is in a wheelchair in Twin Peaks, and she's so sweet and loving and nurturing and kind. There is a twist
right.
that is coming. the mentally handicapped son of Benjamin Horne in Johnny Horne, I think is his name, in Twin Peaks. Those scenes are awkwardly played for laughs.
Right.
And so there is so much of this in many, and this is from the director of The Elephant Man.
Yeah.
Oddly enough.
Which then maybe he was trying to make a comedy out of that. Huh?
Well, I don't know.
Right.
I mean, it's just a very, and might get back to the question of the approach. Why did The Elephant Man in the movie, as opposed to the play, have to have all those prosthetics?
Yeah. Well, that smelled like executives sitting over his shoulder.
It did, but now when you think back on how much hay he tries to make out of
right.
physical... You know, a one-armed man who, of course, you automatically know the man only has one arm because of some evil in his life, because
right.
of some... So this I do not love about David Lynch.
Right. So...
What have we accomplished?
I know if he's listening, he's going to send us an email going, thank you for both. I would now go back to my therapist and see if indeed he is the reflection of me and work accordingly from there. Now I'm totally depressed.
That was really good. Okay, hey, we've been talking about casting so much,
yes.
Our lovely, loyal listener, Karen, who is studying the art of casting, directing.
Oh, yeah.
The art and craft of
Look
of
no
casting.
Further than David Lynch.
I sent her an email for, I think, a paper or something that she's working on where I wrote a little bit to her about casting. The process of it, both from a director's perspective and a casting director's perspective. She followed up with a question about, because I had mentioned to her that quite often both in television and film, the casting director isn't brought on until the leads are already in place.
Right.
And so...
Unfortunately.
Now, you say unfortunately...
Because casting is so important. You want to fill out that whole world based on not just who your leads are, but there's many leads that could take these places, right?
Well, I think with film, we can talk about this, and we can, even whether it's a huge budget film or an independent film, obviously, you know, you're putting a package together to get financing approved. Again, at the huge level or the low level. At the huge level, it's often an actor who's initiated that development package in the first place.
Right.
Because they all have their independent companies.
Production companies.
So
of course, they're attached.
You know, we want to make Pirates 4. Well, we're only going to do it if Johnny Depp says yes.
Right,
period.
Exactly.
Of course, he was already in place. But, you know, this thing, you need the name to get the green light.
To get the funding. To even hire the casting person in the first place.
In the first place, exactly. Right. And the same is true on a lower budget level.
True enough.
You need to have certain names in place, so it often involves...
at lunch.
Connections, exactly. Now, would it be wise to bring in a casting director earlier? Yes, and I think that, you know, it's one of the reasons why you start to see sometimes now casting directors listed as producers.
Yeah.
Because if you give them a vested stake in a project beyond being hired, well, then they might use those connections themselves.
Who better connected than the people who see them every day?
And might help you think a little more outside the box of someone that could hit that level of stardom that you need to trigger financing, but also might be better suited
to the role.
To the role itself. And again, it always depends on, you know, the pecking order of who's brought in.
Right.
If a director is shopping his own script and packaging it, well, then the director might have a really good idea from a casting standpoint.
Mm-hmm.
As opposed to if it's a producer who's bought a script, they might just be thinking of it from a financial
Absolutely.
Standpoint.
And, you know, in Canada, the casting directors actually have more power than the agencies because they... work more closely with the productions that are coming up to then fill out their cast if they're doing a TV series or something. So it is actually the casting directors, and I know actors who work without agents because they have relationships with the casting directors so well
right.
that you don't need the agent to be shopping around for you.
Well, now with television, it seems to me, television is where the casting directors are involved.
Yes.
Right away. Let's say you're doing a pilot.
Right.
Maybe the pilot was put into motion by an actor being involved.
As a stand-up comic who's on the rise.
Still, however, you know, the casting director is probably involved from the very moment that there is a pilot script.
Right.
And even if they're going out to leads to, because no leads are going to commit to it without the script. So even if they're going out to names, a casting director is still used to be negotiating the deal with the agents.
Right.
The producers are not directly picking up the phone to the agents. The casting directors are, and they're going and saying, here's the offer. And then the agent gets to go back to the casting director and say, well, that offer is unacceptable. And then it goes back and forth that way. So that even though we understand that the decisions might actually be made from how much to offer and how much to accept by the actor and the producer,
right.
Well, that relationship is allowed to stay good because if a deal is struck, these people are going to have to work together for a long time.
Right, exactly.
So you want to create the illusion that all the negotiations were done by intermediaries,
right.
And we never knew.
No
so
idea.
Glad the casting director and your agent were able to work this out.
Yeah, somebody tries to hear
for
that.
Us. Yeah. So there's that. And at the same time, what they're doing is they are auditioning actors who are at a lesser level of visibility for those same roles.
Right.
Sometimes it's as backup in case they can't get a name, let's say, that's appropriate for a particular role. Then they might go for someone who's lesser known. Also, though, it's the opportunity to continue to see other actors and how they're developing
right.
and what they might be right for. And this is just a pilot. But boy, we already have in mind ideas of other characters that
yeah.
could come forward, like the brother of the lead. And so let's start reading these people now because it gives us an idea.
An idea. And also for the writers, how to then write to that actor's strength.
casting directors are remarkable people and lovely people, and they I feel that they are under probably as much frustration as almost anyone in the business, because you really you're never allowed to make a decision even when you know it's the right one.
Right, exactly. And then often you hear this movie sank because of bad casting.
Right.
How many times you go, why did that actress or actor get this part? Then that falls squarely on the shoulders, even if that casting director was powerless in trying to get that person out.
Do all casting directors love actors and love the art of acting? Apparently not.
No.
You keep hearing about how the auditioning process is so counter to acting and all this. However, obviously, all the good ones do.
Yeah.
And they do, boy, they go and they see plays. And
see
they
obscure
bring actors
plays.
In.
Yeah.
I love that actors are constantly, you know, complaining, like, why was I even brought in for this? I'm not even right for this or whatever. And instead of thinking about, wow, the casting director wants to bring me in and wants to keep being reminded of what I can do or see different things that I can do.
Right.
And you never know when that casting director is just going to pick up the phone and offer you
yeah.
something. Hey, there's a guest starring thing that's shooting next week.
No, closer.
Closer.
Yeah, like
okay.
that.
I'm all over the map on this show, aren't I?
You sure are.
So I hope that answered a little bit.
I think so. I've even learned something.
Wow.
About casting. Why they should come to this show.
I wanted to ask you about comedy and movies.
Yes.
Because the summer box office season is upon us. It
sure is
already a record-breaking box office season. The box office drought is over. What is ironic about this is that the numbers for Thor, a little bit soft.
Uh-huh.
The numbers for Pirates of the Caribbean 4 in North America, incredibly disappointing.
I mean,
as close to tanking as is possible, although it's the most successful Pirates movie internationally. But yeah, and everybody's quick to blame Pirates 4's failure here on 3D, of going to the well on 3D.
Of going to the well too long.
If you see this movie, there's absolutely no reason to
see it in 3D.
The 3D, there's nothing. And of course, that's to miss the point that there was no reason to make it whatsoever. But
except to erase your taste of Pirates 3.
But you and I have been saying this for quite a while now, that this greed over these 3D prices was rapidly going to bite distributors on the ass.
Of course. And there was no way that even the distributors, the theaters that had to amp up and put 3D projectors into their houses, that cost... They're never going to see that back. I mean, how are you ever going to even break even on the millions of dollars?
Last year, I think there were 6 summer movies in 3D. This year, there's going to be 15, and it'll be really interesting to see how these play. Now, at the same time, I can honestly say that the movie that I'm most looking forward to seeing, and I've been talking about this for a couple weeks, is a 3D movie.
Right.
And it's Werner Herzog's documentary, Cave of Forgotten Dreams.
Cave of Forgotten Dreams. I'm excited to see this movie.
And I actually, in watching Pirates 4 in 3D. And as I said, you know, what is really interesting with this is if you tire of the 3D, you can just close one eye
right.
and watch it in 2D, which is actually kind of looks cooler. And then if you tire of the lack of character, plot, adventure,
everything.
Or your characters, you just close the other eye.
It's that easy.
But I was thinking, you know, wouldn't it be interesting to actually see a mystery in 3D. Now, that might be fun.
That's kind of cool.
Allowing an audience to explore a setting and to
explore. Go through the...
Well, we were talking about location as character.
Yeah.
If you have a film where you want to make location an important character in it, well, then
3D might be... Maybe.
Because that might be what... You know, why 3D was, in part, the right choice for James Cameron with Avatar, because when they're on that world,
that's right,
it made that world
so real,
so real and so unique.
Yeah, absolutely.
So it'll be interesting to see as we've talked about before, the tools of 3D, how they get used in ways, because let's face it, the studios are just thinking, oh, it's a big event film, it's got to be 3D.
Yeah,
they're not thinking about it of, well, why is that right for the story?
Yeah, I don't think anybody thinks that.
But I think Werner Herzog did with his documentary.
Well, yeah, because you're going into a cave where, and that this cave will be not, will sealed up again from the public. I mean, this is one of its last.
Older than Lascaux, right?
Yes.
Older than the cave paintings of Lascaux.
Yeah, it's older than 35,000 years. And it's not, it's going to be sealed back up.
Wow.
I know. So to me, 3D was the only solution.
Much like this sidewalk gallery after June 9th. No?
No. It's going to be open for a couple of months.
Now, like it was a box office record-setting weekend because of comedies. Because The Hangover Part 2, the biggest hit of any R-rated film in history.
Which I hear is Hangover Part 1 told over again.
Yes, and bad reviews. And then you've got Bridesmaids, which is clearly the surprise hit of the year. I mean, it's going to be crossing $200 million.
Wow.
Soon. And at number 7 in the box office on only 50 screens, you've got Woody Allen's new film.
Oh.
So
he's back, is he?
Well, if ever an actor and a director desperately needed each other, it was Owen Wilson and Woody Allen.
Really?
And welcome back to both those gentlemen.
Really?
Actually, they really needed each other, and it is a perfect fit. It's amazing because here's 75-year-old Woody Allen, who is revisiting some of the terrain and the material that he explored in some of his classics like Purple Rose of Cairo.
Never mind that. His stand-up. The whole bit is based on that.
The difference is that the 75-year-old Woody Allen is a man with hope.
Oh.
And who would have guessed that?
I would have never guessed that.
So wow. I was kind of struck by these three comedies being in the top 10 and wondering, what does it say? First of all, it's great that we have three comedies in the top 10 because very few comedies, as we talk about, get made anymore.
Yeah, exactly.
What does it say about us? What is being mirrored to us collectively about these comedies being embraced so much?
Let's see. Can we analyze that instantly? I haven't seen Midnight in Paris, but it is a throwback to a writer who hangs around with all the luminaries of 1920 Paris.
It's
right?
About the myth and the illusion that there's a golden age.
Right.
That things were ever better before.
Right. And that maybe we are living in the golden age. Is that how is that the moral of
and
the story?
And I'm wondering with this idea, because you know how quick I am to dismiss movies like The Hangover for being, you know, the arrested man boys. And even Bridesmaids for really reducing women to the same status.
Right.
Like, is it liberating that we have a comedy that's all women? Yes. And as Nikki Fink argued, you know, when she said, if this thing makes more than $20 million, I'm leaving the country. Because her real criticism, and it's well taken, is that it's not victory to have a female-driven comedy if the women are simply reduced to the same level of adolescence that men get away with.
Right. They're vomiting everywhere, there's flatulence, all of that sort of thing.
It is, of course, fantastic because these are very talented women
right.
who are in the film. And so you love the fact that they're getting the opportunity to show what they're capable of doing. So for me, it was kind of this mixture of, okay, I've got to let go of that thing we've just seen and how disappointing it is that this is where we've come to.
Right.
And I then have to embrace the fact that, okay, these are really talented women.
Right.
And I get to enjoy the fact that they're really being able to show what they can do.
Right.
But there is this interesting thing, is there not, just in the titles, right? The Hangover and Bridesmaids. You know, always a bridesmaid, never a bride, right? And I feel like maybe just culturally we are in this hangover.
Plague of the post-recession milieu of depression and hopelessness.
Pretty much every promise that we were raised on
from
right, has been exposed.
Right.
Has been exposed as flawed in some way or an out-and-out illusion in others.
Right. That there is no American dream, that the M-Dream 2.0 indeed is...
And that hangover has led us to the conclusion that we are all bridesmaids and never the bride.
Absolutely. Because corporate America will crush you like a bug on a windscreen.
And at the same time, here's Woody Allen, who no one has elevated the past and the cultural past in terms of American filmmakers like Woody Allen has.
How many things are black and white?
He is saying, you know what? The golden age is not the past. It may not be right now, but it certainly could be tomorrow.
Ah.
It could be from this step forward. And
When do you ever hear that from Woody Allen?
Right.
I mean, his stand-up was
and
never
yet again,
that.
Who better?
Well,
who better to deliver that message?
After 75 years of Americana.
Yeah.
And what a life he's led. Huh. Okay, now I'm going to see that and the cave thing, and I'll wait for Hangover and Bridesmaid.
Sometimes I feel like we should be making a comedy, Dean Hackney.
Why aren't we making a comedy, Phil Lernes?
Maybe something called Karma Spree, and I have a real idea about that. And Karma Spree is the name of a fantastic script that Dean wrote in a future installment of your Chill Pack Hollywood Hour. We'll have a guest, the fantastic dramatic actor, the incredibly hilarious comedic actor, and rock on tour Gary Anthony Williams as a guest.
As
on a
guest.
Future installment.
Yeah, we're
and we'll talk
that.
A little bit more about Karma Spree.
Let's do that.
It is Memorial Day.
Yes.
We remember those who died in service to their country.
Yes, we do.
This is your Chill Pack Hollywood Hour, where we constantly remember all celebrity deaths and school closings.
Right.
There were two celebrity deaths on the same day leading into the weekend. One was Jeff Conaway from Greece, of course, who had gone into a coma. He was played Kanicki in Greece. He was on Taxi.
As Bobby.
Babylon 5.
Babylon 5.
Of course, he left Taxi for that lucrative film career that amounted to one, I think, Jack in the Box commercial where he turns to the camera and says, "Do it with chicken." And I expressed on Facebook how relieved and sort of, I don't know, just I was overcome by a gratitude that my friends on Facebook, my community chose that night to remember the street poet and musical genius, Gil Scott-Heron.
Right.
Instead of the guy who played Kanicki in Greece. And this was taken by a couple people to be derision and scorn for Jeff Conaway, for Taxi, which somebody even wrote to me was the gold standard of sitcom. And I pointed out, you know, to write something about the death of a street poet in the same sentence where you use the words gold standard to describe a sitcom is odd to me. And again, underscores what I was trying to express, which is just how relieved and kind of impressed I was by our collective that many people chose art over celebrity in that moment.
In that moment.
In that moment. You went to Twitter, you would find nothing about Jeff Conaway, but much about Gil Scott-Heron, a musician who many people had never heard of until his death.
Right, and started researching his work.
And what I was struck by as I was walking here this morning was this sense that, yes, Taxi was a great sitcom. And, of course, Jeff Conaway was on other things. But let's talk about this. Television, historically, was the medium that had the most people aware of it.
Right.
A sitcom at that time, especially, could have 20, 30 million people watching it.
Remember that?
No movie ever draws that amount of people. Very few ever draw that amount of people.
That's true.
The lowest rated television show, if that amount of people went to a movie, it would be a hit, right? Fewer eyeballs see movies. And yet, movies historically have a greater impact on us culturally than do television shows. Historically.
Historically.
And songs may be an even greater impact than, even though fewer people
hear them,
hear songs or buy songs than go to see a movie.
Hmm.
And, of course, books, an even greater impact still, and even fewer people read them.
Right.
And paintings? What about the impact of paintings? And yet, even fewer people probably ever get to see them in person.
Right.
And so it is really interesting that sometimes it isn't about the amount of people. It certainly is not about the amount of people that, I don't know, primarily define something's impact. Right?
That's right.
So anyway, so
interesting.
It was just really, I must say that sometimes I'm surprised.
By your own community.
Yeah, and our willingness, and not only willingness, but desire to claim the importance of art when celebrity seems to be such an easy choice.
Right.
To make.
So that brings you faith. You have hope again in mankind.
Faith.
That art, once again.
Because in the words of the late, great Gil Scott-Heron, the revolution will not be televised, no matter how much of a gold standard the sitcom might be.
Awesome. With that,
I'm Phil Lernis. This is your Chill Pack Hollywood Hour. You can find every episode we ever do every week right here, chillpackhollywood.com, C-H-I-L-L-P-A-K, Hollywood.com. You can, of course, subscribe via iTunes. You can check us out on Jackalope Radio.
Jackalope Radio.
To those of you who do, we thank you. We thank Jackalope Radio.
Profusely.
We thank the Talk Superstation.
Talk Superstation.
And be a liker of the show on Facebook. Facebook.com/ChillPackHollywood.
Follow us on Twitter.
He's /D Haglund.
And he's /Phil Lernes.
And... oh, and we've got a bonus, a fourth anniversary bonus show that's going out to the people who've ordered it.
Oh, yeah.
Write us at chillpackhollywood@yahoo.com, chillpackhollywood@yahoo.com for the bonus.
Hilarious bonus.
Anniversary show.
Outtakes.
That will never be available any other way.
That's right.
Other than an email. By writing us, chillpackhollywood@yahoo.com. Is there anything else we need to people know about?
We'll tell them next week. We'll have another show.
Hey, if you're going to be in the Malibu area,
oh yeah,
we've got a screening on June 4th, Saturday, June 4th, at the Olandar Foundation for Emerging Renaissance.
Check our website, the
truth dash is no, that's not on there.
Oh,
we haven't done that.
Oh, then just on Facebook.
Yeah,
check Facebook out the Truth Movie.
Right,
Facebook. Yep.
Yeah, facebook.com/truthmovie.
Yeah, and then come to my show June 9th, right downtown L.A. Till next week, I'm Dean Haglund.
Phil Lernes.